Okay, well, I'll read a few of these to give you a little flavor of just some of the stuff that I found and how you can... the court denied a motion to dismiss because individuals who control and direct the practices of a collection firm can be personally liable, even if they act under the auspices of a corporate entity. In addition, they may be liable as persons who directly or indirectly collect or attempt to collect a debt. And this is in Florida. The employees of a debt collection, here's another one. The employees of a debt collection agency who actually engaged in the allegedly unlawful misconduct in the collection agency itself are jointly and severally liable for the resulting FDCPA violations. Okay, over on the next page, Terry, third paragraph up from the bottom, Kurt versus Diversified Collection, private guaranteed student loan debt collectors are subject to the FDCPA.
Awesome.
Okay, next page.
Where's my highlighter?
Yeah. See, what I do is when I get a little time for distraction, with this small print, I can only do so much reading at a time. I go through here and I read some with my highlighter, and when I catch the good ones, I hit them with a highlighter and circle them. Okay, next page, 858, down in Minnesota. The purchaser of defaulted debt portfolios was a debt collector. You're going to love this one.
Which one is it?
This is Minnesota, Munoz versus Pipestone Financial.
On that same page?
Yeah, 858.
Oh, okay.
Near the bottom on the left column.
Okay.
The purchaser of defaulted debt portfolios was a debt collector, notwithstanding that it itself did not communicate with the consumer in an attempt to collect debt, and where instead the actual collection efforts were performed by another debt collector with whom it contracted.
Ha, ha, ha.
How's that for tying some people in? Okay, next page, 859, third one down. Crop versus professional collection. Employees of the debt collector personally involved with the violative conduct are personally liable under the FDCPA. Next one, the court rejected the defendant's contention that only collection agencies and not individuals are liable under the FDCPA, holding to the contrary, that officers and employees of the debt collecting agency may be jointly and severally liable with the agency where they have affirmatively acted. Next one, Reed versus Alvarez.
Oh, that's so perfect for Midland.
See, this is good stuff. The individuals who were personally involved in the collection of the debts at issue were debt collectors subject to the FDCPA.
Oh.
Okay, over in the right-hand column, first one under Pennsylvania, Alamo versus ABC. Merely identifying oneself as a debt collector does not make one a debt collector under the FDCPA. And that's something that I mentioned because I had read this before. I mentioned that when I did my webinar recently, that you have to state they are. You can't use their self-admission against them. Doesn't work. Okay, next page, 860. It should, but it doesn't. Okay, page 860, bottom paragraph left column, Hester versus Graham. Where an attorney is a debt collector is a determination to be made on a case-by-case basis applying the following principles. Attorneys qualify as debt collectors for purposes of the FDCPA when they regularly engage in consumer debt collection, such as litigation, on behalf of a creditor client. A person may regularly collect debts, even if debt collection is not the principal purpose of his business. If the volume of a person's debt collection services is great enough, it is irrelevant that these services only amount to a small fraction of this total business activity. Whether a party regularly attempts to collect debts is determined, of course, by the volume or frequency of its debt collection activities. The defendant attorneys were acting regularly and thus were debt collectors as defined when over the previous 2 years they attempted to collect debts on 450 occasions for four clients and filed nearly 200 collection suits.
I would call that regular activity.
Yeah. Okay. Next page, 861, second paragraph. Addison versus Brand. Attorneys who regularly engaged in debt collection litigation were debt collectors for the purposes of FDCPA. Two-thirds of the way down, Frey v. Gangwish. The validation notice must be provided within 5 days of the initial communication, even where the first communication was an attorney's post-judgment letter to the consumer. Bottom paragraph, Carroll versus Wolpoff and Abramson. The 1986 amendment to the FDCPA to eliminate the exclusion of attorneys from the definition of debt collector was a repeal, not a reenactment, which generally incorporates prior judicial decisions.
Well, you know, Wolpoff and Abramson, they just get hammered, don't they?
Well, they did. See, that was Wolpoff and Abramson became... just drawing a blank. Who's out of business?
Huh?
I just can't think of their name. But they were in Rockville, Maryland. But anyway, top of the column on the right page, Crossley versus Lieberman. An attorney routinely collecting debts as a debt collector under 1692. Okay, down about a third of the way, Newman versus Checkwright. The FDCPA applies to lawyers engaged in litigation. Second one under Colorado. Vicarious liability will be imposed on an attorney's client for the attorney's FDCPA violations if the attorney and the client were both debt collectors.
I like that.
Yeah, next page, second full paragraph, Woolfolk versus Rubin. Definition of debt collector includes any attorney who engages in debt collection more than a few times a year. Two paragraphs down, Yale New Haven Hospital simply stated, if an attorney regularly engages in debt collection activities, that attorney is a debt collector under the FDCPA and is subject to its provisions. This court holds there is no additional implied exemption for attorneys when performing tasks of a legal nature. Okay, skip down to Florida. First one, Agin versus Katzman. The court applied Hines versus Jenkins, holding that an attorney can be a debt collector under the FDCPA if he regularly engages in consumer debt collection activity. Right-hand column, third paragraph down, Donnelly versus Nordic. A creditor seeking to collect its own debt was not a debt collector. However, its attorney seeking to collect its debt was a debt collector.
Yeah, that's gold.
I love it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Down about two-thirds of the way, Laws versus Cheslock. By listing his own name and attorney at law in large font at the top of the page, the creditor's in-house collection lawyer gave the misleading impression that he was a solo practitioner. Other factors included the statement that the matter had been referred to me for collection, quote unquote, the reference to my office, quote unquote, and the use of plural pronouns. The presence of the creditor's name in the letterhead was only one factor in determining whether the attorney employed by the creditor acted in the name of the creditor. Whether a lawyer was a debt collector could be decided as a matter of law, where Dunning letter could lead an unsophisticated consumer into believing the lawyer did not work as an employee of the creditor.
Okay, which one was that? I had to go get my other glasses.
Laws versus Cheslock, about two-thirds of the way down, right-hand column on 862.
Oh, I see it. Okay, got it.
Okay, the next one right underneath that, Egley versus Bass. Allegations of the attorney's personal involvement in collection activities was sufficient to hold him or her personally liable under the FDCPA. Okay, over in the right-hand column, right column near the bottom, page 863, the last one before Maryland, Johnson versus Eaton. Decision by Congress, 1986, deletion by Congress of the attorney exemption from the definition of debt collector left nothing to indicate that attorneys in the course of litigation are engaged in purely legal activities. Activities that can only be performed by an attorney should be excluded from the requirements of the FDCPA.
No.
Okay, next next page, 864 in Michigan, third one in Michigan, Stojanovsky. A law firm which collected debts only 4% of the time was a debt collector because such activity was regular and brought law firm within 1692A6.
Ooh, as little as 4%.
Bottom one, New Jersey, Chosky versus Hudson. The court rejected the defendant's motion to dismiss the claim against her individually because the allegation spoke to actions completed in her professional capacity as an attorney for the law firm that owned the plaintiff's debt. Attorneys may be held liable for misleading statements made on behalf of their clients. That's a good one.
Yes,
right-hand
is.
Column, second one under New Mexico, Colker versus Sanchez. An attorney who regularly files lawsuits to collect consumer debts was a debt collector. Okay, we'll skip over to the right page, far right column, second one up at the top, Delente versus McKenna. The court denied the motion to dismiss by the law firm representing a creditor as it found the law firm was a debt collector under the FDCPA as it regularly engaged in debt collection for others. Skip two paragraphs, last one right before Rhode Island, Crosley versus Lieberman. FDCPA applies to an attorney whose collection work is a minor but regular part of his general practice. Next page, Wisconsin, Thomas versus Bass. Filing a complaint and other aspects of litigation were actions in connection with the collection of a debt. Funny thing. Okay, now we're going to skip some here. I'm going to go to where I got my next bookmark. I'm going to go to page 903. Okay, under California, second one, Schwarm versus Craighead. Personal FDCPA liability can be imposed on employees, shareholders, officers, and directors without piercing the corporate veil, as long as the individual, one, materially participated in collecting the debt at issue, two, exercised control over the affairs of the business, three, was personally involved in the collection of the debt at issue, or four, and mind you, this is or, four, was regularly engaged directly and indirectly in the collection of debts. The individual defendant had FDCPA liability, whereas a director and president, the individual oversaw collecting debts pursuant to contracts with the district attorney's offices, was one of only four of only three individuals that had final authority over the company's collection procedures, developed the automated software the company used, and was solely responsible for managing and maintaining the automated computer system that implemented the collection program.
Ooh.
Right column, second paragraph, First Interstate Bank. Vicarious liability will be imposed on an attorney's client for the attorney's FDCPA violations if the attorney and client were both debt collectors. Now, see, there was another one where he had that same exact statements.
Yeah, and I think that was First Interstate, too, with someone else.
Yeah. Okay. Under Connecticut, Cashman. Partnership may be sued under the FDCPA since it is reasonable or responsible for the acts of its partners.
Oh, very good, very good.
Okay, let's go down to Florida, the first one, LeBlanc versus Unifund. FDCPA liability was imputed under the FDCPA and state partnership law to the general partners of defendant that only participated indirectly in its actual collection efforts. Don't you just love this stuff? Okay, page 905, flip a page, right-hand side, almost halfway down, New Mexico. debt collectors employing attorneys or other agents to carry out debt collection practices that violate the FDCPA are vicariously liable for their agent's conduct. Next page, 906, halfway down, Albanese versus Portnoff. The law firm's president with duties of supervision and overall responsibility and the attorney who signed the letters could both be liable under the FDCPA. Under Utah, second one, Brumlow versus Law Offices. Even if shareholders were not directly involved in the collection efforts, there was a factual question whether they could be liable as indirect debt collectors since they exercised supervisory authority over the corporation, were intimately involved with the practices and procedures of the corporation, and in fact developed and implemented the particular collection practice. Right-hand column under Virginia, West versus Costin. A collection agency and its individual collection employees are all debt collectors, separately liable for their separate violations of the FDCPA. By piercing the corporate veil, the owner of the collection agency was also found liable for FDCPA violations. I just love this stuff. Okay. Let's go to... Oh my God, there's a whole bunch of it here. Page 908. Jeez. Actual damages are not required for standing under the FDCPA as the attempt to recover unlawful fees was made actionable by Congress.
Wait, which one? Where are you at?
This is the second one, right-hand column, Roby versus Shapiro. Sorry,
oh, I see.
I forgot
okay.
to mention where I was. A little ways down, Montgomery versus Huntington Bank and Silver. A non-debtor who was subject to abusive collection tactics may not maintain an action for violations of 1692 CC, since that section is limited to violations directed at a consumer, as defined in the Act, but may maintain an action for violations of 1692D and 1692E, which have no limitation and therefore apply to anyone who is the victim of prescribed misconduct.
Oh, that one's important.
Yes, it is. Okay, skip down a couple, Keel versus Wexler. The FDCPA is designed to protect consumers from the unscrupulous antics of debt collectors.
I like that.
Irrespective
antics.
Of whether a valid debt actually exists. Okay, skip to Baker versus GC. The Act is designed to protect consumers who have been victimized by unscrupulous debt collectors, regardless of whether a valid debt actually exists. Under Alabama, first one, Sparks versus Phillips. Any person can be a plaintiff, not just a consumer.
Oh, I love it.
Okay, next page, Delaware, third of the way down, Dutton versus Wolhar. The protections of the FDCPA are not limited to consumers. Liability is imposed upon a debt collector who has failed to comply with the Act with respect to any person. Pursuant to 1692K. Okay, Florida, Drozen versus National Action Finance. Plaintiff who received an initial pre-recorded telephone message from the debt collector and then a letter from the same entity stating that she owed a debt had standing to assert FDCPA claims arising from the telephone message that was allegedly intended for another person with the same last name as plaintiff. The FDCPA is broadly written to provide standing to any person, quote unquote, and should be liberally construed to protect alleged debtors.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, top of the right column, Fulton versus Creditor Services. The court denied the collection agency's motion to dismiss the FDCPA claims, finding that plaintiff, a former collection attorney for the collection agency, had sufficiently stated a cause of action by alleging that the collection agency forged his signature to at least 29 legal documents filed in court in connection with the collection agency's efforts to collect debts, violating 1692E3. The collection attorney withdrew the forged complaints and terminated his relationship with the agency. The court noted that the FDCPA was broadly written to accord a private right of action to any person.
Even the attorney, yeah.
Yes. The next one, Harvey versus National Action. Plaintiff filed for bankruptcy after receiving collection letter. Plaintiff had standing to pursue FDCPA suit based on the collection letter where plaintiff amended her personal property schedule to include her FDCPA claim as 100% exempt, and the trustee did not object to the listing or assert a right to control the claim. How's that for a cute little ditty having to do with BK?
Yeah.
Okay, the next one, Flowers versus Accelerated. The spouse of a consumer may bring FDCPA claim if debt collection efforts that would violate the act were targeted at her. A husband to which a collection call was targeted had standing to sue where the threats to sue and garnish his wages were received by his wife. Love it. Next page, right-hand column up at the top, Michigan. Kanuski. One who knows that he is not alleged to owe the debt is not a consumer and does not have standing to bring claims under 1692 ENG, but does have standing as any person to bring claims pursuant to 1692 D. Gotta have the right thing that you make your claim under. Okay, Missouri, Thomas versus Consumer Adjustment. Third party who answered the call had standing to sue the debt collector. The focus of Section 1692CB and 1692B is not solely on communication with the consumer. It also regulates the content of the communication with third parties and prescribes certain conduct, such as communicating with the third party more than once. Under the unique facts here, where the third party alleges direct harm and actual damages, she has standing. Next to the bottom, not the bottom, below that, Bank versus Pentagroup Financial. The court erroneously held that one who received recorded calls aimed at a different consumer has no standing under 1692C. Plaintiff lacks standing to bring a claim under 1692C because, one, he was not obligated or allegedly obligated to pay any debt, and two, he has not alleged that he is a consumer spouse, parent, guardian, executor, or administrator. Accordingly, defendant's motion to dismiss the claim is granted. Now, that's one. It shows what you have to do properly.
Yep, they failed to make the right claim.
Exactly. Okay, next page, first full paragraph, Sibirsky. Husband who was not a consumer could pursue FDCPA claims under sections not restricted to consumers, such as an E5 claim. Since husband did not owe the rent debt or receive the 3-day demand letter, his claim for violation of the notice requirements, which applied only to consumers, was dismissed. See, it applies only to consumers. Okay, about halfway down there, Riveria versus MAB Collections. The FDCPA private remedy is available to any person, quote-unquote, not just consumers. Therefore, the administrator who had received dunning letters regarding a consumer debt had standing to sue under the FDCPA. North Carolina, Johnson versus Bullhead Investments. The consumer, a person with a name similar to the actual debtor, who was served with the actual debtor's state court collection suit even after she notified the collector of the mistaken identity and who incurred attorney's fees in having the collection case against her dismissed and incurred other actual damages as a result of the debt collector's collection efforts, had standing FDCPA violations. Okay, right-hand column, third, fourth one down under Pennsylvania, Woodside versus New Jersey. Plaintiffs were consumers protected by the FDCPA despite defendants' argument that they are not, because plaintiffs have the ability but not the desire to pay the collector's claim. Okay, next page. Third from the bottom left column. This is under communications covered. This is Donahue versus Quick Collect. A state court complaint served directly on a consumer to facilitate debt collection efforts is a communication subject to the requirements of 1692E and F. Last one, Edwards versus Niagara Credit Solutions. Telephone answering machine messages, you're going to love this one. Telephone answering machine messages that ask the consumer to return calls from the defendant debt collector.
Which
and
one
that
is this?
Did not convey any specific information about a debt were nevertheless communications subject to the FDCPA, since the reason for the calls was to collect a debt and they thus indirectly conveyed information about the debt. Almost
Kobe
halfway down.
OARS.
Okay, now, directly to the right of the words communications covered, Goldman versus Cohen. A legal pleading was a communication within meaning of the FDCPA. Okay, next page, top. McClenning versus NCO. Question of fact was raised as to whether or not the defendant failed to cease collection of the debt in violation of 1692GB when it made a soft pull credit inquiry.
Where are we at?
We are page 913, the very first citation.
Oh, McClenning, okay.
Yeah, now, Terry? Listen to that. A question of fact was raised as to whether or not the defendant failed to cease collection of the debt in violation of GB when it made a soft pull credit inquiry.
In other words, they had been disputed and they pulled their credit.
Uh-huh. Okay, next one. Kobe versus ARS. Voicemail messages from debt collectors to debtors are communications, regardless of whether a debt is mentioned in the message.
And that's one of their favorite claims.
Mm-hmm. Next one, Costa versus National Action. Telephone messages left by a debt collector are communications subject to the FDCPA. Down at the bottom of that column, Illinois, Hutton versus CB Accounts. Leaving a voicemail message to call back is a communication because the purpose was to induce the consumer to call to discuss her outstanding
debt.
Oh,
that's beautiful.
Okay, the next one, Matt Mann, Boeing, whatever it is, communications to lawyers and the court are subject to 1692E of the FDCPA, just like communications to consumers.
And the court. Oh, yes, indeed.
Okay, the next one, Ramirez versus Apex. The court rejected Biggs versus Credit Collections and followed the overwhelming majority rule of Foti et al. That the debt collector's voicemail messages were FDCPA communications. I just love it. Are we having fun yet, you guys?
Oh, absolutely. It makes you
okay.
Want to kiss the people who spent all the time compiling all this case.
Yeah. Page 914, second one under Michigan, left column. Gathing versus mortgage electronic registration. Since FDCPA prohibits actions and unfair practices that may not involve communicating directly with the consumer, pro se allegations the co-defendant was debt collecting or debt collector's servicing agent and that co-defendant debt collector is vicariously liable for its servicing agent's acts under the doctrine of respondeat superior survives motion to dismiss. Summary judgment denied where co-defendant servicing agent offers no support for its contention that statements made in a letter that also includes language required by law or in a response to an inquiry by a plaintiff are exempt from compliance with the FDCPA. Now, that one's a little convoluted, but it's something to look at. Okay, down at the bottom, under Minnesota, the second one starts at the bottom of the column. Actually, the verbiage is a top right column. The court has learned through its work on you'll love this one. The court has learned through its work on countless FDCPA cases that threatening to report and reporting debts to CRAs is one of the most commonly used arrows in the debt collector's quiver. Consistent with the views of the FTC and consistent with the views expressed in Purnell, Quayle, and Semper, the court finds that Midland was engaged in collection of the debt in violation of 1692GB when it reported EDA's disputed debt to the CRAs before sending verification of that debt to EDA.
Oh,
isn't that a beauty? Okay, next one, Seaworth versus Miserly. The court concluded that a pleading sent to the pro se consumer's home but never received was not a communication. Okay, if you don't receive it, you don't have a communication, do you?
Nope.
Okay, the next one, Mark versus J.C. Christensen.
What was that?
Messages left
wait,
by
wait,
the...
Wait, stop. What was that question?
Yeah, I was wondering what that last case was where you just said if they sent it and the guy didn't receive it. What was the case law on that?
This is Seaworth versus Messerly, M-E-S-S-E-R-L-I. It's District of Minnesota, September of 2010. S-E-A-W-O-R-T-H versus Messerly.
You know, that's exactly what the NCO is trying to tell me, that they sent me a letter in May and I didn't respond, therefore I waived my 1692GB.
Yeah. Well,
too bad.
The court concluded. Yeah, here you go. The court concluded that a pleading sent to the pro se consumer's home. Now, this is a pleading.
But it doesn't matter.
Sent to the pro se consumer's home but never received was not a communication. So, you know, you'd have to go read the case law decision.
Right, therefore. But being it clearly says that just because they say they sent something.
Exactly.
Does not mean you. They've got to be able to prove you actually got it.
There you go. That's always their problem if we challenge it and challenge it aggressively. Okay. Next one, Mark versus J.C. Christensen. Messages left by the debt collector on the consumer's answering machine are communications under the FDCPA. Okay, second one under Missouri, Thomas versus Consumer Adjustment. Even though the debt collector did not disclose any information about the account, since the call was made for the purpose of contacting the debtor to obtain collection, it was a communication within 1692A2.
Love it.
Okay, next page, North Carolina, Davis versus TransUnion. Reporting to credit bureaus is a communication within the FDCPA. Allegation that collection agency falsely reported the balance of an account to a credit bureau survive motion to dismiss. Now, that's big right there. Because we've been talking about that. Reporting to credit bureaus is a communication within the FDCPA. Okay, the next one. First one under Ohio, Midland Funding, favorite name. Affidavits attached to complaints for money themselves constitute communications for the purposes of the FDCPA.
Oh, boy.
Okay, the last one right above Oklahoma, in regard to Gunter, summons and complaint are communications within the FDCPA. Okay, in Oklahoma, Mendes versus Morgan, a pleading or a summons was a communication under the FDCPA and was the initial communication triggering the validation notice requirements.
And how many times have we seen magistrates try to say that it's not?
Yeah, yeah. The filing court papers against you is not a collection action. That's, you know, that's not an initial communication. Well, there's case law that says otherwise.
Exactly.
And that's from the Oklahoma Court of Appeals in 1999. Okay, Capital Credit and Collection Service, the second one under Oregon. A false, deceptive, or misleading representation or means in connection with the collection of any debt under 1692E includes communications by the debt collector to the debtor's attorney, since the FDCPA applies to direct and indirect collection efforts. Pennsylvania. Henry versus Shapiro. The FDCPA includes the contents of formal pleadings within its scope, except where formal pleadings are explicitly exempted by E11 and GD. Okay, fourth one down there, Inman versus NCO. Followed FODI. Holding pre-recorded messages left on an answering machine were communications. Okay, down the last one right before the Texas, Sullivan versus Equifax. The court rejected the argument that sending false information about a delinquent payment to a credit reporting agency was not debt collection conduct. Okay, under Texas, last one, column blanks versus Ford Motor Credit. The court rejected the argument that sending false information about a delinquent payment to a credit reporting agency was not debt collection conduct. Next page. California. State court collection complaints are generally subject to the FDCPA. Okay, then we're going to skip all the way over to the next page on 917, first column almost near the bottom, Ruth versus Triumph Partnerships. The FDCPA is a strict liability statute, and debt collectors whose conduct falls short of its requirements are liable here, respective of their intentions. Top right-hand column, Jacobson versus Healthcare. The Act is primarily a consumer protection statute, and we have consistently interpreted the statute with that congressional object in mind. Skip one down to Brown versus Card Services. The FDCPA is a remedial statute to be broadly construed so as to affect its purpose. Skip one down to Johnson versus Riddle. FDCPA is a remedial statute to be liberally construed to accomplish its purpose. Third from the bottom, Frey v. Gangwish. FDCPA is an extraordinarily broad statute and must be enforced as Congress has written it.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Scott, the next one, Scott versus Jones. Sparse legislative history has relatively little persuasive weight in comparison to the plain meaning of the statute.
That's gold.
Yeah, that's Fourth Circuit from 92. bottom one, Jeter versus Credit Bureau. Since the purposes of the FDCPA stated in 1692 included the strengthening of federal protections for consumers, courts should interpret the FDCPA to be at least as protective of consumers as was the FTC Act at the time when the FDCPA was enacted. Thus, into the new page, thus the FDCPA's objective standard should be construed to be protective of consumers who are unsophisticated and relatively more susceptible to abuse. Third one down, Federal Trade Commission versus Schaffner. Although Congress intended the act to be enforced primarily by consumers, it also authorized the FTC to use all its functions and powers to enforce compliance. Okay, second one in Arizona, Hayden versus Rapid Collections. Collectors' reliance on information from the creditor was immaterial since the FDCPA is a strict liability statute. The court recognized that such reliance might be an aspect of the bona fide error defense. Okay, down in California, second one, Reyes versus Kenosian. Contents of state court complaint are subject to the FDCPA. The next one, Cassidy versus Union Adjustment. the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Heintz strongly suggests that the Knorr-Pennington doctrine does not apply to FDCPA actions. We'd have to go look and see what that states. Here's a good one. The next column, Irwin versus Mascot. Since the FDCPA is a strict liability statute, no showing of intent was necessary to establish liability. Under Colorado, O'Connor versus Checkwright, FDCPA is a strict liability statute and only one violation need be shown to entitle consumer to summary judgment. Don't you like that? That's out of the District of Colorado. Under Connecticut, Sercot versus Diversified, the FDCPA is remedial in nature and should be liberally construed. The next one, Ayala, FDCPA should be construed to accomplish the regulatory goals intended by Congress. Let's go down to the first and second, well, third, first three under Florida. The FDCPA establishes a strict liability standard and requires only one violation for a consumer to prevail. A debt collector may still violate the FDCPA while simultaneously following an authorized state procedure. I thought that was very interesting. FDCPA is a strict liability statute, so the consumer need not show that the violation was intentional. The FDCPA's prohibition barring collectors from leaving pre-recorded voicemail collection messages that are heard by unauthorized third parties does not violate the First Amendment, since the prohibition is narrowly tailored to serve the significant government interest of protecting consumers' privacy, and debt collectors have several alternative methods of communications available to them, including live conversation versus telephone and person and postal. Okay, that was kind of interesting because it somebody made an argument that it was unconstitutional, which is baloney. Okay, let's see. Kaplan, the FDCPA was a strict liability statute, and knowledge or intent need not be pleaded. Georgia, the FDCPA is a strict liability statute such that no evidence of intent to mislead or deceive is necessary. How many times have they argued that? Next one, Illinois, Ross. Because it is designed to protect consumers, the FDCPA is generally liberally construed. Top of the next page, Kansas, McDaniel. FDCPA is a remedial statute which should be construed liberally in favor of the consumer. Second one under Minnesota, Bishop. FDCPA imposes strict liability without regard to whether the consumer was misled by the violation. Next one, Pish versus Hawks. FDCPA is a remedial strict liability statute which was intended to be applied in a liberal manner. Under Nevada, Pittman, there was no requirement under 1692E that false representations be intentional to be actionable. Because the FDCPA is a strict liability statute, defendant's culpability was a consideration only in computing damages under 1692K. Consumer had a reasonable expectation of privacy at her work during the working hours that arose from a desire to be left alone to perform the duties for which she was hired. She stated a claim for invasion of seclusion. Then in New Jersey, first one, Boyko versus American Intern. FDCPA is generally a strict liability statute and does not require proof of actual damages to support a claim. We get arguments all the time. Well, they didn't sustain any actual damages. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, or they'll say, well, where's your actual damages when you didn't even claim any?
Right, okay. Bottom one in that column under New York, Cavaliero. The FDCPA is a strict liability statute, quotes Russell versus Equifax ARS. In the general context of consumer protection, of which the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is a part, it does not seem unfair to require that one who deliberately goes perilously close to an area of prescribed conduct shall take the risk that he may cross the line. Okay, under Ohio, Deere versus Javich, the Sixth Circuit has described the statute as extraordinarily broad, quote unquote, and its terms must be liberally enforced. Skip down to just above Oregon, Becker versus Montgomery. FDCPA is, for the most part, a strict liability statute. Under Pennsylvania, Mashinsky, FDCPA is a remedial statute, should be construed broadly. Next one, read. FDCPA is a remedial statute and should be construed broadly. Excuse me. Texas. Garros. FDCPA is a strict liability statute, and only one violation of the FDCPA is necessary to establish civil liability. Okay, and then I'm going to skip. Okay, that's all I got for right now. But here's one. Tennessee, Brown versus Hosco. This is page 944. Top left under Tennessee. The court denied the motion to dismiss where the frequency of the debt collector's calls to the plaintiff's telephone and the manner in which the collector called the plaintiff's cellular telephone using an automatic telephone dialing system could plausibly cause an unsophisticated consumer to feel harassed, depressed, or abused.
Oh, beautiful.
Well, here's a couple others. I actually skipped a couple of pages. Jeez. I skipped a bunch of stuff here. I guess I got to backtrack a little bit. I see I've got all sorts of bookmarks in this thing, and I don't know whether my bookmarks got pulled or what. Okay, let's go to page 938. Let me get a quick drink here. You talk about a battering ram for these arguments. 938, bottom one left-hand column under New Jersey, Kashuk. The requirement that a collector cease communications under 1692cc is effective upon the collector's actual receipt of the consumer's request that communication cease, even if the collector has not processed the request and has no actual knowledge of the request. It's effective the moment they receive it and their mail person signs for it.
Oh, that is good.
New York, right-hand column, second one, Johnson versus Equifax. Consumers' written demand to the collector that it verify the debt pursuant to 1692G and otherwise cease all other communication effectively invoked the Section 1692CC cease communication remedy and did not improperly attempt to have it both ways, and the collector's subsequent communications other than to provide verification comprised an additional dun and affidavits of forgery for the consumer to sign violated 1692CC. Down to Ohio, Lamb versus M&M. Debt collectors continued collection. My eyes are just really raising hell with me. This is very difficult. Debt collectors continued collection efforts after receipt of consumer's letter stating that she would not pay until she received the requested breakdown did not violate 1692CC because refusal was conditional. Okay, kind of watch the details. Next page, under other, go down to Florida, about a third of the way down, Chalik versus Westport Recovery. The FDCPA does not guarantee a debt collector the right to have to leave answering machine messages. Debt collectors have other methods to reach debtors, including postal mail, in person contact, and speaking directly by phone. Okay, under Indiana, Spearman versus Tom Wood. Legal pleadings constituted a communication as defined by the FDCPA.
Nope.
Yes, sir, and that's the Southern District of Indiana. Okay, let's go to the next page, 940. Two-thirds of the way down, a couple up from Montana, Herbert versus Wexler. The statement, you cannot even begin to know the trouble and expense that is about to come into your life over this matter, as we intend to do whatever is necessary to compel you to pay this obligation, stated a cause of action for violation of 92D2, as the unsophisticated consumer may construe the language as having the natural consequence to harass, oppress, or abuse the debtor.
or even physically harm. I mean, that was pretty strong language.
Yep. Hoffman versus Partners, the next one right there. Plaintiff was not required to identify in the complaint the particular abusive words alleged to violate 92D2 in order to survive defendant's motion to dismiss. Okay, Montana, McCullough versus Johnson. The inescapable conclusion is that the debt collection attorney asked a pro se defendant to admit false information. This is a goodie. He either did so knowingly or neglected to review his minimal file before signing the request. He served the request with no ostensible reason to believe that the consumer, defendant, would understand their import. The request for admissions appeared to be designed to conclusively establish each element of the collection law firm's case against the consumer and to use the power of the judicial process against a pro se defendant to collect a time-barred debt. This conduct is abusive, unfair, and unconscionable.
Yeah, abusive discovery.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Exactly. Okay, halfway down New York, Arroyo. Student loan collector's insulting statement, if proven, the consumer who couldn't afford $100 monthly payments should have thought about that when she entered a student loan would violate 92D. Okay, under Oregon, McNall versus Credit Bureau, consumer stated a claim for relief for defendant's violation of 92D when their agents, while attempting to serve process, stood at the entrance of the consumer's home and in a very loud voice repeatedly yelled plaintiff's name, "Come out of your house. I have legal papers for you. You need to come out and get these legal papers now. You need to get your ass out here and open your gate now. I'm not leaving until you come out and open this gate." I think that's a little trouble there for him, maybe. Okay, Pennsylvania down here.
I think they'd have been looking like cantaloupes and might have got the business end of my shotgun.
Yeah. Under Pennsylvania, Frew, the assertion that the defendant allegedly likened plaintiff to a scumbag stated a claim for using an abusive collection practice prohibited by the FDCPA. Okay. Now, next page, repeated or continuous phone calls. First one, Meadows versus Franklin. This is 11th Circuit. The court reversed the lower court's entry of summary judgment for the collector on 92D5 claim. The collector called the plaintiff's parent of a debtor residence over 300 times in a 2.5-year period, sometimes up to 3 times a day, using mostly robocalls but also personal calls. In addition, the collector sought contact information regarding the plaintiff's adult daughter and another debtor who previously had the same phone number. Court found that a reasonable jury could conclude that the collector caused the phone to ring with the intent to annoy, harass her, in the view of the volume and who's calling me here?
I thought it was mine.
No, it's mine. Hold on. I got to call him back. That's about setting up dinner time for tonight. Okay, the court found that a reasonable jury could have concluded the collector caused the phone to ring with the intent to annoy or harass her in view of the volume and frequency of the calls, the fact that the plaintiff had informed the collector that she did not owe the debts, did not wish to share her daughter's contact information, asked that the call stop, and stated the calls caused her emotional distress. Court found that the fact that the telephone calls were not answered was no defense to the D5 claim. Since the provision specifically prohibits merely causing a telephone to ring with the requisite intent, the statute itself recognizes answering the phone is not necessary for there to be harassment. This makes good sense because a ringing telephone, even if screened and unanswered, can be harassing, especially if it rings on a consistent basis over a prolonged period of time and concerns debts that one does not owe. Okay.
I'm thinking about bringing another one against ARS FDCPA because under those Bates records, all those calls I never got, oh my God, how many there are to my landline.
Yeah. Okay, next page, 942, a little over halfway down, third one in Florida, Clark versus Weltman, Weinberg, and Weiss. a complaint alleging that over a 2.5 month period, 26 messages were left on the consumer's cell phone was sufficient under Twombly and Iqbal to constitute a violation of 92D, even if they also constituted a violation of the TCPA. Each element of the particular statutory claim must be met, regardless of whether the same facts support multiple claims. Okay, that's all on that page. Next page, bottom of the first column under New York, at you versus Redline. The court found that it was not necessary in a claim under 92D5 for the consumer to allege that the defendant made a certain number of phone calls. Also, there is no requirement under this section that the consumer answer the phone. Instead, it is enough that the defendant merely causes the phone to ring continuously with the intent to annoy, abuse, or harass. Right-hand column, a little over halfway down, second one under Oregon, Clark versus Quick. Court denied summary judgment to defendant where it had called multiple times without leaving messages. Whether there is actionable harassment or annoyance turns on the volume of calls made and on the pattern of calls within 1692D. Next page, that's the one was Tennessee, the court denied motion.
Yeah.
Okay, I already read that one.
Let me scoot up here.
I think that may be it. I think that was all that I skipped there. Yeah, that's all the farther I've read. Was that enough to wet your whistle?